class, and otherwise known as Brian's Story Time. I'm going to spend the next until, I guess I got to save 15, 20 minutes for evaluations, but until I run out of time, I'm basically going to talk through various stories from the past decade and a half of crypto, starting with, I call this the politics of crypto, starting with export controls and the government, then moving on to the Clipper chip, and then moving on to, John stole a little bit of my thunder, but I'll talk about DMCA from a legal and policy side of the world, because it's stuff that comes up, and we'll kind of take it where it goes, because this is kind of fun stuff. So why talk about crypto politics? Because you can't really avoid it. The short answer is that pre-1999, the regulations were sufficiently complex around crypto that you had teams of people involved in getting out. You basically could not ship strong crypto out of the country. You actually had to have an arms merchant identifier in order to file the paperwork to do so. So, you know, my coworker at Microsoft would get stopped when she crossed the border because her passport would get flagged because she was registered as an arms merchant because someone had to sign the paperwork saying that we wanted to export crypto somewhere. There are import controls, too, on crypto that still exist today in various countries. France, Russia, China, I don't know, maybe North Dakota, you know, places like that. There's crypto requirements. But the fact is that there are still export controls in the U.S. There are still import controls in various countries in the world. Talk to your lawyer if you are thinking of doing anything involving distribution and are worried. I'm not a lawyer. I don't play one on the net, but I'll give you my experience. And finally, this point here that just because a government tells you crypto is freely exportable, don't believe what they say, because what they tell you and what the regs may be are very different, as we have learned the hard way at the time.
Guess which wins in court.
Yeah, the regs win in court. So, we'll start with export controls, then go on to some of the other topics. As I said, I'm going to present a U.S.-centric view of the world, because that's what I know best. I can tell you a little bit about some of the import problems I have run into over the years sending crypto to other places around the world. There are places you legally can't send crypto, the seven terror-supporting nations, where we can't basically send anything. You can't send crypto there either.
Somehow they still get it, though.
Yeah, they download PGP or something off the web, you know. It's freely available. But, you know, I think, you know, technically, I think Syria, Iran, North Korea, Cuba, and, you know, the couple others that are on the list.
Libya may be off.
Libya may or may not, I forget. These are national issues, right? Crypto is seen as a munition and a matter, obviously, of national security. And a lot of what we have learned about this has come from Freedom of Information Act requests filed by people like the EFF, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, the ACLU, places like that. Governments don't like to talk about this policy, so you're not going to get a lot of answers. Yes, you can go to the National Cryptologic Museum that's next door to NSA. I strongly recommend the trip if you're ever in suburban Maryland and out near NSA. It's a fun thing to do. It's a little motel that used to be where the Russians would sit to spy on the NSA, so the NSA finally just bought out the motel and turned it into a museum. There's a lot of there, but they're not going to tell you about some of this sort of stuff, so for obvious reasons.
In fact, they pretty much stop at 1950.
Yeah, maybe go a little bit past that. All right, so in the beginning, crypto, both hardware and software, but really hardware because all classic cryptographic devices were hardware devices, were controlled as munitions by the U.S. government. They were written into the law and covered by the same export regs that covered things like nuclear weapons, machinery for making nuclear weapons, machinery for making the fuses for nuclear weapons, machinery for making the machinery for making the fuses for nuclear weapons, the submarine that launches the nuclear weapon, and other sorts of things like this. And this was called something called ITAR, International Traffic in Arms Regulations. There's a similar sort of agreement called the Wassenaar Arrangement, which is an arrangement among sort of the Western powers about controlling munitions, dual-use technologies and things like that, and crypto falls into that. But basically, crypto was treated as a hardware device. If you wanted to send a device overseas that was a crypto device, you needed to go file paperwork to get an export license, just like if you were exporting a big gun. Matt Blaze, who was a cryptographer at AT&T when I was there, told a story about how he actually tried to legally declare a piece of cryptography that he was taking out of the country. And he went to JFK early, about 3 hours before his international flight, and said he needed to file an ITAR form to take out this cryptographic telephone unit that he was taking as part of his baggage to bring back, which was allowed under the regs if he declared it.
Three hours?
He was there 3 hours ahead of time.
Our company makes us take 30 days.
Well, Matt, yes, Matt's different, and Matt showed up at JFK and said, I'd like to declare that I'm exporting an item under ITAR, and they said, say what? And he explained what he needed, and they called down, they said, hold on, and after about 15 minutes, some guy comes and says, okay, where's the guy who wants to export the big gun? So, you know, that's kind of, you know, where we were. Now, everything, all exports of crypto, required a license. If you were exporting weak crypto, which meant 56-bit symmetric keys, actually 40-bit symmetric keys, you couldn't export DES. You could not export DES. Even when DES was known to be weak, you couldn't export DES. 40-bit you could export and it was known as weak. Strong crypto, could, and you had to get a license for that. Strong crypto, you couldn't export at all. Crypto with a hole couldn't be exported either. Now, what is crypto with a hole? Crypto with a hole is a pluggable API. So, you've taken object-oriented programming. You know that you design an API, you know your algorithms are going to change, you design it that you plug the algorithm in. You don't even want the algorithm, you're just going to ship the API that people plug into. That was protected. Under the same theory that you can't, that the machinery to generate the bomb that makes the fuses for the nuclear weapon is restricted, and the machinery that makes the propeller that makes the subsilent that's going to launch the bomb is protected, the machinery that would allow you to plug crypto into a word processor or an operating system was protected. So crypto with a hole was also covered under this. Now,
when did they start doing the export controls? 1560s?
Geez, I would believe so. I don't even know how far back it goes.
It really only became relevant in the 70s.
Yeah, I mean, until we basically had public key crypto, it was sort of irrelevant. Now, I'm gonna go off camera here for just a second, because I need to get my handouts here, or my visual aids. So crypto was protected under export control, and you were not allowed to export it, except paper and books was not. So in 1995, some of you may have heard of PGP and Phil Zimmerman, and Phil got into some patent trouble with PGP as well, and there was a real big fight going on because he kind of implemented PGP using RSA and didn't have a patent license for it, and kind of felt he didn't need one, and there was a big fight. I ran the first web-based PGP key server at MIT. MIT held the patent on RSA but gave an exclusive license to the company that was suing Phil. So Ron Rivest was down the hall, and I did not quite get a threatening letter about taking down my key server for PGP because it would have been threatening the patent holder, which was kind of confusing. Anyway, Phil decided he wanted to export PGP, and we did a deal where he actually got a non-commercial use license from RSA. Well, the way we exported PGP legally to the U.S. was in this book. We printed up the source code for PGP in an OCRable font, with comment characters around the page numbers so the binding could be easily split and scanned on the other end and pieced back together, all almost 1,000 pages of it, 900 pages, plus you had a variable index and other sorts of things.
Wow.
Okay, and so in 1995, the MIT Press put out, you know, I don't know, maybe 1,000 copies of the book. They actually sold pretty well. copies got shipped overseas because
they were DRM protected.
They were not DRM protected, it was OCRable. And this is how PGP 2.6.5, I think. I forget exactly which version this was. But whatever version of PGP this was, I think it was 2.6.2. And it got exported in this book form, and it magically got sliced apart and OCR'd by elves and put together and ended up on the web internationally.
Shocked
that this would happen, that they would take a book. Because, you know, text is not export controlled. Books, publicly published books are not. Question.
Didn't you get into trouble with government over that?
Not with this. Okay, not with this. Phil, so there was a lot of talk. So We could spend an entire class talking about the history of PGP.
Or Phil.
There are plenty of websites where you can go read stuff. Just go search on it. There was both some patent issues. The government was investigating him for a long time over the original export because a copy of PGP ended up available internationally, earlier versions, and the government was trying to, you know, make an example out of Phil, and Phil suffered a lot for that. Okay, so you know, no one should sort of doubt what some of these folks really went through to sort of make the, you know, the fact.
Although, in all fairness, our government has actually gotten a lot better.
Our government has gotten a lot better, but we still suffer from export controls. Okay, it is still the case that even today, as I'll get onto a bit. So let me finish the story. So, because this was 2.6. PGP had a version 3, I guess version 4 never went anywhere. Version 5 was a major rewrite, and it actually was put out by PGP Incorporated, which was a company that was founded to get a license. So in 97, I got 17 volumes like this of the PGP5 source code, and the stack comes up to about here, if you guys can see that. And 5 of these copies were distributed at a Cypherpunks meeting that was held, if I remember correctly, at the SDI buildings in California, which have now been taken over by Google, so certain things come full circle. 5 of these copies of, and this is again one of like 17 volumes of the independent platform, independent source code, the Mac version, the Windows version, and a copy of this magically showed up over in Norway, like by FedEx the following day, where it got scanned in, same thing, OCRable font, that sort of thing, and that's how PGP 5 got out of the US. Because we couldn't ship it electronically, but we could ship it in print form, and so a number of these. I have t-shirts at home that say this t-shirt is ammunition with a copy of, like, you know, RSA and 4 lines of Perl sitting on it, you know, or something like that. You know, and, you know, people used to, you know, wear these things. You know, barcode versions on the back, too. There was a whole industry in this at the time. Until January of 2000, you couldn't export anything over 56 bits in length. There was a period, I think, where they let you go up to do DES, after DES had been cracked, basically, and shown it could be brute forced quickly. In January 2000, the Clinton administration rewrote the export controls. They changed ITAR to become the export administration regs. They claimed they were looser. What the regs basically did was make a distinction between linking crypto directly into your application and crypto with a whole, and whether you were a commercial product or an open source product. So what they basically said was, if you were a monolithic application, imagine that you wrote a web browser and you baked the crypto into the browser, or a secure mail application or something like that, you could export that simply by sending the Bureau of Export Administration a piece of email effectively and say, hi, I'm shipping this thing, here's the algs that are baked into it. If you had crypto libraries that other people called and they were open source, you could send them a URL to where the source code was published, and you could just put them up on the web. Before that, you had to do all these tricks where you could put them up on an FTP site, but you had to make people go through this 4-question test, swearing that they were a U.S. citizen or a citizen of a country that had an arrangement, and they weren't going to export it, and they understood
what
it
was.
And people never lied. And it, like, did, you know, one of these rotating FTP directory type things.
I think those questions also would check your IP address and kind of see if you were coming from.
I can.
Because I know Netscape, I think, did that. But
yeah, the ones at MIT, I don't believe, did.
But they did at one point, because we tried to get it from MIT.
And you couldn't?
From the UK.
And they blocked it?
In about 94 or 95. And then I came out of Seattle and saw a copy of the book.
Okay, so there you go. You know, we got around things as best we could. Crypto with a hole, though. Okay, was still under the new regs tightly controlled.
I have trouble understanding that. The strong crypto itself you can export, but the crypto with a hole you can't.
That's correct. So, here's the, as far as we can tell, the reasoning is, if you, the strong crypto, because you have to identify what the algs are, they know what algs are shipping. And it's about what algs are available to the person. Crypto with a hole wouldn't necessarily let you know as an eavesdropper, say. Not that anyone in the U.S. eavesdrops on any communications. What algs are being used, okay? And it's an odd sort of thing. It didn't make a lot of sense, but that, as far as we could tell, was the issue. Question.
What about, like, OpenSSL usually comes with some standard algs, right?
Yes.
But it also has applicable frameworks.
They fall under this exemption. They're open source.
Okay.
As long as the source code was publicly available, the government kind of knew they were lost, okay? Now, you could argue that there are very few pluggable crypto libraries that aren't open source that matter. In fact, there are some that would say there's one that matters, okay? And that this was, therefore, this was called the Microsoft exemption. There are some people who sort of argue that. And that basically it was designed to sort of prohibit sort of the open licensing of strong crypto, okay? Out of Windows. So what happens in XP, even today, we ship with certain strong algs baked into the box. We're allowed to ship 4096 bit RSA. I think we actually go higher than that now. Triple DES, AES as a service pack 2 or service pack 1. And it's exportable because it's a monolithic application. It's a pluggable API, though, what we call crypto API. That's not freely exportable. So what happens is this thing actually does a signature check and will only load plug-in modules that have been signed by Microsoft. This is a deal that goes back to about 94-95. Microsoft was wanted to ship a crypto API, and back then under the old regs, the deal we struck with NSA was we would create an API that would basically look for a digital signature on the plugin module, and we would only sign things that had that were either weak crypto or had appropriate, you know, export approval from NSA or from the Bureau of Export Administration, or were only going to North America. And so one of my first jobs at Microsoft was to go into the vault two or three times a week and go and sign people's cryptographic service providers to plug into our API. And that was the way the API, although that actually is still in use today. We have a newer one that's coming out with the next release of the operating system that is differently, but this is what happens. Questions?
So given where Microsoft does a lot of their development, is India part of North America now?
None of the crypto development happens outside of the U.S. And that was another issue for us. Under the old regs, it wasn't just the seven terrorist nations that you couldn't send crypto to, right? You could not allow foreigners from certain countries to see the source code. So, for example, the crypto source code was not part of our standard source servers because we couldn't guarantee that, say, an employee from a country like Russia that was banned from receiving crypto under the export controls could sync to the file, you know, to the source depot tree. And so we had to control, our own source code had to be controlled and separated internally. The build process was complicated because of this. Development happens in the U.S. and that sort of thing. There's a, you know, that becomes part of the problem. It's gotten easier now, but there was a problem with foreigners having access to it in general, and we had to sort of watch for that early on. Question back.
Microsoft Research in India, they do some crypto work.
Are
they not allowed to collaborate?
First off, those regs have changed now, okay? And second, they're kind of just starting up. I will say I think it raised a couple of eyebrows when that announcement happened, okay? raised some of our eyebrows, too. It is odd. I'll tell you that you know, we do, of course, a lot of business with defense communities, right? Defense communities like to know that the crypto is being homegrown. You know, they like to know who's working on it. And this is true about sort of any country you want, right? And the odd thing is, as a multinational company, while we'll put in the latest SHA-2 hash functions, which everyone kind of agrees on, they came from NSA, and we think, well, they're really about as good as anything else at the moment. There are countries in the world that don't trust any algorithm that comes out of the U.S. So, for example, we have received requests from both the Chinese government and the Japanese government where they want to be able to plug in their own ciphers at deep, low levels in the operating system because they don't, you know, they don't necessarily say why, but the implication is they don't trust it. Russia has its own favorite ciphers. The European Union has a different set of hash functions based on something called RIPMD that they happen to like and have put in the standards in places. And this does become a national pride issue, but it is a national security issue for them. And so that's pushing a lot. So it's not just pluggable APIs, but changing where the algs get used down in like IPsec and stuff like that.
Are you starting to notice that changing with the just increased globalization and stuff like that?
Certainly we're getting more requests for it. It sort of is, from my perspective, it's following what happened with PKI and root certificates. Whereas in the late 90s, we started getting a lot more requests from international certificate authorities to put their root certs in the browser and in the operating system because they sort of wanted to have their own presence.
You're saying we're getting more requests for...
We're getting more requests today for the pluggability of ciphers than we did 5 years ago. Okay? And not just... And sometimes, in some cases, that's... Well, we have a hardware implementation of AES we want to plug in. But more generally, we get requests that are, we have our own cipher we'd like to use. Now, that doesn't make a lot of sense from an international, from an interoperability perspective. Okay? But from a, we'd like all the citizens behind the Great Firewall of China to use a particular algorithm, makes more sense. Okay? And that sort of thing. So, the regs are still ambiguous, and this is an absolutely true story. So, there's this thing called the .NET framework, which is an object-oriented class library for a virtual machine similar to Java that runs in Windows. I did the crypto library port in one of my previous jobs. We went to the Bureau of Export Administration and said, okay, we have an object model for crypto. It supports inheritance. It supports subclassing. These are very standard object-oriented techniques. Is it export controlled or not? It took them 18 months to come back and give us an answer. So that you have it on
the...
We're
almost done testing by then.
And we're almost done testing by then. So here's a sample of what it looks like. There's an abstract class, right, like it says over here, called Symmetric Alg. And then we had abstract classes underneath it for things like TripleDes, Rheindahl, RC2. We didn't actually call it AES yet because it wasn't formally AES. And then we had implementation classes down here that plugged in and subclassed. Now, you think, okay, object model, big deal, right? Here's the answer that came back. Opening up the bottom classes, the bottom abstract classes, it was okay to let people subclass those. It was not okay to let people subclass the top classes. So in particular, we were allowed to let people subclass this class and this class and this class. So this arrow was okay. Okay. But they told us that if we wanted to ship this, we would have to protect that subclass interface there. And you could only subclass the metric algorithm and add on something else if you had a license. Okay? Didn't make a lot of sense. That's what came back to us. And we said, well, we don't really like that. Okay, so what can we do? Well, we decided to use the open source exemption. So we published the open sources to our object model. No crypto code got published. We published the source code and made it freely available on the web for anyone to download and inspect and sent the URL off to Bureau of Export Administration for the abstract definition of the symmetric algorithm class. So we literally had a class that said symmetric algorithm has a key property, you know, has a key length and an IV size and a block size and, you know, has these sorts of properties. Had no crypto code whatsoever. But it was export controlled if we didn't do that. Okay, so that's kind of the situation we were in as early, you know, as 2001, 2004. Check with your favorite crypto lawyer if you're going to do any of these sorts of things. The regs are getting better. They're supposed to get revised again, we hear, this year, and hopefully that some of this craziness will go away. But there has been this, you know, give some, take some back sort of step that the government's gone through where they've kind of made some relaxations. And I'll be honest, most of the relaxations have happened only grudgingly after the fact that the open source community basically put stuff up on the web. And the fact that you go download OpenSSL from a whole bunch of places or PGP from a whole bunch of places worldwide and things like that changed the dynamics of it, you know. And I do believe, and this is a personal belief, that part of the reason they kept some of the regs around was because they didn't want commercial software to have the strong have strong stuff as pluggable easily because it made it easier for folks to go use it. But the fact is we know that the folks we care about listening in on today, for the most part, either aren't using electronic communications at all, because they're sending messages up and down the hills in Afghanistan, or they get strong crypto anyway, you know, and it's not really going to stop stuff. But that's kind of the situation. Okay.
Oh, boy.
So, key escrow. Now, at the same time that we were having all these fights in the early mid-90s, the government decided that crypto was potentially going to block them from listening in on people, and they might want to listen in on a few people in the future. They didn't really know. And so they proposed something called key escrow, or a scheme in which they would mandate technologies that they could listen in on if you wanted to have encrypted communications over the phone. Now, we have looked at key escrow a little bit in one of the past problem sets, and there are legitimate reasons when you might want to escrow an encryption key, okay? Data recovery sorts of things. I always use the crosstown beer truck example. You got the guy who has the encryption key in his head, and he gets hit by that crosstown beer truck, and he's gone. And you need access to the data, okay? So key, whether you call it key escrow or key archival or GAC, government access to keys, that was the one the cypherpunks liked using, it's all kind of the same idea. There are no legitimate cases from a commercial perspective or any sort of others for archiving session keys, secret session keys. Okay? All of the archive, when you talk about key escrow, you're talking about stored data. Archiving the access to data. What the government wanted was access to transient session keys. If I set up, we do a Diffie-Hellman key exchange and I'm talking to you, that key gets archived so that if they save the data off, they can go get it later. Okay? Because, we don't care, right? If we have a conversation and something happens and the data doesn't get there on the other side, we'll send it again. Big deal. But that's what was at the issue in the key escrow debates. And the government spent a lot of time trying to convince businesses that they needed to escrow their transient session keys in addition to their long-term storage keys. And where this really came out was the move to digital telephony. Because as we were starting to digitize our long-distance phone lines, the government saw that as a threat to their ability to wiretap. Because in the analog world, you went in and you just tapped a pair of wires, and you listened in with the headphones. Yeah.
Incidentally, have you ever read Cringely's discussion of the wiretapping machines, the system that's currently supposed to be used?
So I've read a lot on things like carnivore systems and stuff like that. Yeah,
they're talking about how there was a server in an open room that you just walked into and could log into without like any password or something, and you could wiretap whoever you wanted to. I don't know about that.
I do know that there was a law called CALEA. Still is. What is it? Law enforcement assistance, right? It was passed in about the same time. I may have a slide on CALEA later. I forget. That basically forced the telephone companies to make their digital systems wiretap accessible for the government. And it wasn't like in the old days where you'd go into the local central office and plug in a pair of alligator clips and put on a headphones and listen. They wanted the calls routed remotely to locations. Okay. Now, the fact of the matter is that digital community, all of our intercontinental digital traffic basically leaves the shores of the United States through a very small number of access points. So all of the transoceanic cables happen to go by Fort Meade, Maryland, or pretty close to that, as it turns out, or go by certain parts on the West Coast, And there's, NSA's got a big listening facility south of Yakima that's got a bunch of stuff that they don't talk about, but it's sort of publicly known, and there's other facilities. They're building stuff out in Colorado.
Is that the military installation on I-82 or something?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a big NSA facility.
Okay.
I mean, they won't officially say that, but there's enough out there that says, yeah, it is.
Okay.
And there have been, secret submarine missions to get on tap undersea cables and stuff like that. So, it's a big business. But anyway, what the government was worried about was going to digital communications and not having the ability to view the stuff. So they decided that what they were going to do was they were going to stimulate the market for voluntary key escrow equipment. Okay? And what they did was they contracted with AT&T, Ma Bell, to produce Clipper phones. These were phones for government use that were going to have key escrow chips in them. And the government theory was they're going to voluntarily buy a whole bunch of these phones, and then other people would buy those phones too to have secure communications that only the government could listen into anytime they wanted. Okay? And they'd be available for non, there was a gift for the government. It was strong crypto from the government available for non-commercial use. Just the fact that your keys were escrowed and people could go get at them. And there was this thing called the LEAF field, the law enforcement access field, and the protocol that would allow you to kind of go, that was the thing that every time you sent a packet of data, it was encrypted, but it was some key that was tied to the chip in your phone and to some family of chips, and it was tagged, and if they saved that data off, they could go to some special vault and pull the keys out and decrypt the content. So it was a tamper-resistant hardware device that was sort of added to the phone. Each chip was numbered, had its own key in it. These things were archived with the U.S. government in some facility somewhere. Per-session keys were encrypted with a per-chip key. The per-chip key was sort of sent along, encrypted with a family key as part of the data stream. I mean, not the per-chip key. The per-session key was, and the chip key was identified. And then someone listening in on the conversation wouldn't be able to listen into the data, but they'd get enough metadata in there to say, oh, okay, this is the key I need to go find to go crack the thing open. And there were going to be little hardware devices go decrypt this, and they're going to make it all nice and, you know, everything okay. And they let in, you know, it was a secret algorithm.
Skipjack.
That was an 80-bit cipher, 80-bit symmetric cipher, which they let a bunch of cryptographers view for a day. They basically invited a bunch of people in on the Willy Wonka tour of NSA, and they, you know, said, okay, here you go, you can look at it for a bit, and now bless it. And they said, well, we didn't see anything wrong with it in the 8 hours we were given to look at it, you know, but that sort of thing. So basically, you had this family key, a chip ID, the encryption key. This was, I think, the encryption key for the some piece of the chip key that was encrypted, the family key. This was an identifier, the session key for the system, and then a checksum. And the checksum was only like 16 bits. And that was basically sort of what you sent around. You sent this 128-bit field that identified the conversation. So the other party sort of decrypts it. And if you send a bogus leap field, the chip turns off and refuses to decrypt. So if that checksum didn't compute, okay, you know, you couldn't fake it out. So some of the weaknesses in the system. Well, first off, you had an 80-bit session key, which was really too small.
What SHA, the 160-bit SHA.
Yeah, so the reason that SHA is 160 bits of the hash function is because it was sized to match an 80-bit symmetric cipher. Birthday attack, so he wants to verify. And it was sized for the 160-bit subfield in the digital signature algorithm, which was originally 512 bits, even though we told them it was too small. So that's why where the 80 came from. And as far as we know, Skipjack was basically some algorithm that NSA had on its shelf of ciphers, because they have a big shelf of ciphers somewhere. And they pulled one off and kind of said, okay, we'll use this. The 16-bit checksum could be depleted. Matt Blaze showed in 94 how you could fake out the Clipper chip and basically send a bogus leaf field that the checksum would still match and get the phones to work without it actually sending the proper decryption data along. So the system was kind of, you know, anyone who wanted to defeat the escrow properties of the system could do so. And, of course, every single communication was tagged. So you knew who was talking to whom because you had all the encryption data from the phone.
Did you defeat that as well?
No, not that part, as far as I know. But to be honest, just showing that you could basically turn off the escrow feature was sort of sufficient. What was really odd was that the cryptographic community had kind of been this loose-knit thing and wasn't really, you know, congealing together, except when Clipper came out, it galvanized everybody. And all of a sudden, you know, you had nerds marching in the streets with signs and stuff like that. It got proposed as the federal escrow encryption standard. It got rammed through NIST into FIPS 185. There were 300 comments received, of which 2 supported it. No one bought it. AT&T shut the line down. They offered the leftover phones to employees. This happened while I was there to get rid of them. My boss bought one for like $500 or $600 just so he could say he actually owned a Clipper phone. Wasn't that great a phone? It probably did more to galvanize the community and the strong crypto community than anything else the government could have done. Okay.
Now, Brian, this was to get rid of the phones or get rid of the employees?
Oh, yeah, we get rid of the phones, okay? The employees they've been getting rid of ever since the successive mergers and things, apparently. No, another 20,000 are going to go. What galvanized it for me, what really brought home that this was a big thing, was the following advertisement that I believe appeared at one point in the New York Times, but certainly at other points. This was the famous RSA Data Security Sync Clipper ad, which basically, you know, was a political statement on crypto that appeared in major publications and, you know, because some things are better left unread. You know, that was a little tagline down there in the bottom. And you saw people with Sync Clipper t-shirts, key rings, hats, you know, all this sort of stuff. And it really did galvanize the industry. And you still go back and you can look and say, how could the government kind of do that? Well, we've seen sort of other behavior along those lines. You kind of wonder, maybe that's, you know, what happened.
What administration was in power at the time?
That was the Clinton administration.
Yeah, that's also kind of, you know, a reversal of
You know something, when it comes to this, I think, you know, both sides of the administration, I don't think you can say anything about one party or another. I think at the end of the day, It was odd because on the one hand, that administration was seen as being more tech-friendly and being more tech-savvy. But, and this was really pushed by Gore, actually, in that administration.
Fought through the internet.
And when that happened, it really set all of us like, you know, what the hell, right? It also did cause a lot of groupies to come to the annual crypto conference in Santa Barbara. So, you know, all
that's where the cheerleaders
No, the cheerleaders didn't come from that, you know. But the it really did just change the industry. You had the rise of the cypherpunks, which were, you know, doing, you know, strong crypto in various places and, you know, passing stuff out and, you know, distributing source code and helping people set up PGP and playing random swap of their Safeway cards so that Safeway couldn't match groceries bought to people anymore. You know, they did stuff, you know, protests like that. And it really was, it was a different time. And now, you know, the regs kind of changed, and, you know, enough crypto basically got out there that it wasn't practical for them to try and enforce
it. This really killed it, though. By the end of this, the government said, okay.
They basically gave up on it. But this was a serious attempt, you know, where they were going to require that federal employees, you know, use these things for, now, only for, of course, non-classified information. Okay? NSA has had a secret, you know, there have been a large number of secure telephone units called SNUs. I think about this. The famous one was the SNU 3, but they're actually beyond it now. And they have, you know, portable cell phones that have, you know, classified algorithms in them that they can do stuff with. And they've had that for a long time. I mean, you can go back to the Crypto Museum and watch, you know, they've actually got demos of some of the machines from the 50s that gave you, you know, like, you know, 3 kilohertz of encrypted traffic, you know, because the sound quality was really poor.
Wow.
So they've had, you know, secure voice communication for ages. They kind of wanted the civilian employees to, you know, have to use semi-secure to kind of kickstart the industry. AT&T lost a bundle on this. I mean, they invested a ton and, you know, kind of went nowhere and got a black eye for it and that sort of thing. So that's that.
And who was Matt Blaze working for at the time?
AT&T, of course. And, you know, a lot of people, and even within AT&T, you know, it was like, what the hell's going on? Because it was sort of, on the one hand, you had the crypto research team breaking stuff, but on the other hand, you had their federal systems group trying to build the phones, and, you know, it was one of those sorts of things. Okay, how much time do we have to leave?
We can presumably take a few more minutes.
Okay.
Well, I leave it to the class. You know, we've got evaluation to do. How much time do you want?
I've got 6 slides left. I'll go. Okay. So, I could talk about copyright a lot longer, but I'm going to try and keep this short. As John pointed out, with the rise of digital rights management and crypto's role in it, it has come more to the forefront, mostly because crypto is used as the protection system. This slide I'm going to skip because you kind of know about it, and I could talk about fair use for a long time, but we won't do that tonight. The DMCA, the Digital Millennial Copyright Act, which was pushed as a minor change to the law, but in fact was a sweeping change in the way in which copyright law, the force of copyright law in the U.S., which happened about 2000, if I remember correctly. There is this section in 17 U.S.C. 1201, which is the section of the law that deals with sort of copyrights. No person shall circumvent a technological measure that effectively controls access to a work protected under copyright law. What it says is, you know, section of this title, I think, is what it actually says. All right, so what's effectively protect mean? Well, it basically means anything you want it to mean. So if you have a technological protection measure, such as a bit that says, don't copy me, and you change that bit from a 1 to a 0, which means from don't copy me to it's okay to copy me, you have bypassed an effective technical protection measure under the DMCA, and you've committed a crime. Okay.
But if you circumvented it, it's not an effective technical measure.
No, that's the problem. Okay? Circumvention. Good try, and a lot of people have tried that argument, but it turns out ROT 13 qualifies as an effective technical protection measure.
That Russian guy.
And they did. In fact, I'm going to talk about that in a little bit later. I have a bunch of cases I'll go through in the next couple slides. But look at this. A technical protection measure effectively controls access to a work if the measure in the ordinary course of its operation requires the application of information with the authority of the copyright owner to gain access. So there was this serial copy management scheme that was originally proposed for digital audio tape that was basically a bit, or, you know, that was or a notch, actually, that was knocked into it. There were limited exemptions for encryption research and reverse engineering, But the encryption research ones even kind of require that you go and get approval ahead of time. And if the you had to give notice to the guy whose system you were going to go break or attempt to break before you could before the exception kicked in. So you had to go tell the person, say, "Oh, by the way, I'm about to try and go break your system. Please don't sue me because I think I have a defense." Okay? That's kind of the way the law went. Now, the most famous of these cases, as was talked about, was around the DECSS system. DVDs are, well, they're encrypted, but kind of. They're encrypted using a 40-bit key because it had to be exportable, because DVDs couldn't use strong crypto, because then you couldn't export to DVD players. Or import them from the places they were being made, actually, because they'd probably be made overseas. So when you put a DVD in, the DVD has to authenticate itself to the player, and there's a little challenge response system that happens. And that's called the content scrambling system, is the encryption scheme, and DECSS from Jan Johansson in Norway, if I have it right, wrote, cracked it, basically, put out a nice little program to undo it so he could play it on his Linux box. And what happened was, he got sued, but he got okay in Norway. The guys who published 2600 the Hacker Quarterly actually published, a pointer to this thing on their website, and the Motion Picture Academy of America sued them for publishing a pointer to the program, saying that they were helping facilitate, cracking and circumvention of an effective technological protection measure, and that lawsuit the MPAA won, and 2600 had to basically take the pointers down. There have been a bunch of other cases, which I'm just going to talk about real briefly. And let me start from the top and kind of work backwards. Most recently, there was a big fight using the DMCA between Blizzard. Blizzard is the company that makes World of Warcraft and a bunch of these other real-time strategy games, and an open-source project called BNetD, which came up with a public open-source matchmaking server, as opposed to having to go through the official servers that Blizzard ran that you had to subscribe to. And Blizzard used the DMCA to get BNetD shut down on the basis of the authentication protocol that they had to reverse engineer to go use it. Felton versus RIAA, it was a case that came out of something called SDMI. And I forget what SDMI stood for, but it was the watermark. John referred to it.
Digital Music Initiative.
It was a watermark. It was a proposed watermarking standard for music. And Felton and a bunch of his grad students at Princeton went and basically broke all the watermarking schemes. And there was a lot of controversy over when they get their paper actually published at the, I think it was the Information Hiding Workshop, if I remember correctly, because the conference was, there was a threat of, if you publish this and talk about it, we're going to sue you for violating the DMCA sort of thing. 321 Studios put out DVD backup archival software, okay, that used effectively the same measure, the same equipment as the DECSS did. They got sued and run out of business by both Macrovision, which holds patents on analog copy protection systems, and then MGM, which is, of course, one of the major studios. As folks talking about earlier, U.S. versus Kliarov. So here's a guy, and I forget, I want to say Anton, but I'm not sure that's his first name, worked for Elcomsoft, which was a Russian company, that came out with a product that bypassed Adobe's ebook protection system. He comes over to the U.S. to Las Vegas to go talk at Black Hat or something like that. I forget. Was it Black Hat? I forget. But he
it was Vladimir.
Was it Vladimir? Okay, Vladimir. Yeah, that's right. That sounds right. Comes over to the U.S. to attend a conference, gets arrested by the FBI while he's speaking in the U.S. on this sort of thing. Because his company makes the software overseas and sells it overseas, gets held in jail. Adobe said, well, we didn't really tell the FBI to go arrest him. We didn't file a thing, a complaint, and they got a bunch of bad press on it. EFF came to defense, and eventually they dropped the charges and that sort of thing, but it was another one of these sorts of cases. These last two are...
Dmitri, that's right.
Good call.
Don't forget something else. The Russia required... They have be able to break those ebook formats too. It's Russian law. That was one of their defenses. But they were just doing what they're supposed.
They were doing what they were supposed to be doing, and that they had complete legal authority under this Russian law to be able to break the ebook protection. Yeah, that was another twist to it. The U.S. didn't seem to care. Yeah. The last two I'll leave you with very quickly: Lexmark versus Static Control. So Lexmark makes printers. and they make printer cartridges. And any of you who have bought a printer recently know that the money's in the ink in inkjet printers. HP will gladly give you a printer for free if you only buy HP ink.
They'll pay you money.
They will pay you money for it.
That's true of laser printers, too.
Yes, yes. But at least there is some non-trivial cost that the inkjet printers basically won't. I mean, there's basically no cost. Lexmark had an authentication protocol between their ink cartridges and the printer. And so Static Control, I believe, came up with either a refill or a duplicate cartridge sort of things. And Lexmark sued them for violating the DMCA, claiming that they circumvented an effective protection measure, that the program, either the program or the inkjet thing itself, was copyrighted. I guess it would have been the program, and they bypassed the circumvention. Lexmark lost that one, luckily, but it went up a bit.
So is that the same reason why when you refill a HP cartridge, you have to play this little game with the little dots on the...
Yeah, I've never actually...
That's a tape with the...
There's all sorts of stuff. You know that also the draft, when you buy the economy cartridges, they just have half the ink in them of the regular ones. You know, so there's all these sorts of games on that. Chamberlain versus Skylink was even more interesting. Chamberlain makes garage door openers. And Skylink, I think, made the things that go in the cars that kind of learn and open the garage door so that you don't have to carry the garage door opener around. Chamberlain sued them for a DMCA violation for making something that was compatible with their garage door openers, claiming that the protocol between, you know, they had some stupid little protocol, but they also have a patent on it, between the garage door opener and the receiver, you know, the remote and the actual thing, that if you reverse engineered that to make something that was equivalent, that you were violating the DMCA to do so. And that got thrown out as well, or they lost the case. But the fact is that the DMCA has come up in a lot of cases that had nothing to do with copyright law and protection of digital works and things like that, where folks have tried to twist it to cover other sorts of places.
That's like practically anything that's reverse engineering of...
Well, that's a
real software.
Possibly you could try it, and the courts have, you know, there's been various, you know, things on both sides on that. But yeah,
that sounds like that's the direction people are trying.
That's they're trying to, the ones that basically, you know, I mean, there is a reverse engineering exception, and you are allowed to reverse engineer certain sorts of things. You got to do it kind of right. You got to do it in a clean room environment, sort of thing. But yeah, they've been trying. There's been a number, and I'm sure there will be more along the way. All right, so it's 9:20. So thanks. I that actually was just kind of all I was going to talk about. And I guess we got to do evaluations.
Let's evaluations. Great. Thanks.